God forbid Israel after 135 AD. The Apostle Paul in Romans went to a great length to explain why the Jewish nation had lost their favored position with Jehovah and how this opened the way for a people who were not a nation, the Gentiles, to be called by God, along with a remnant of Israel to become his people. After explaining the reason for them losing their favored position, Paul goes on to pose the question, did God cast off his people? He then spends the rest of the chapter 11 explaining why they had not been cast off forever. I say then, did God cast off his people? God forbid. For I am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham and of the tribe of Benjamin. God did not cast off his people, which he foreknew. Or now we know, we know what the scripture saith of Elijah, how he pleaded with God against Israel. Lord, they have killed thy prophets. They have digged down their altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have left for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. Romans 11:1-5. Paul then goes on to explain that the Gentiles were grafted in to the Jewish root. I say then, did they stumble that they might fall? God forbid. But by their fall, salvation has come unto the Gentiles to provoke them to jealousy. Now, if their fall is the riches of the world, and their loss the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? Romans 11:11-12. Paul then goes on to explain, for if the casting away of them is the reconciliation of the world, what then the receiving of them be but life from the dead? Romans 11:15. Along with these explanations of how this fits in with God's plan, he issues a warning to the Gentile converts, saying, for if God spared not the natural branches, neither will he spare thee. Romans 11:21. The Gentile converts are given a warning to become, not to become conceited or to vilify the Jewish nation. Paul then goes on to explain the mystery of Israel's salvation. For I would not, brethren, have you ignorant of this mystery, lest you be wise in your own conceits, that a hardening in part has befallen Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved, even as it is written, then shall come out of Zion the deliverer. He shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. Romans 11:25-27. Paul has brought to their attention some of the promises that have been made to their fathers. In the days to come, Jacob will take root, and Israel will blossom and sprout, and they will fill the whole world with fruit. Therefore, though this through Jacob's iniquity will be forgiven, and this will be the full price of the pardoning of his sins, when he makes all the older stones like pulverized chalk stones, when ashram and incense altars will not stand. The rise of anti-Semitism. It's interesting that, or surprising really, that the attacks on the Jews began less than 100 years after Paul had written the letter to the Romans. Here are just a few of the examples. Hieronymus, 135 to 202, strongly emphasized that Christians should avoid any kind of relationship with Jews in order to prevent confusion in their faith. He wanted the church to be cleansed from all Jewish elements. Ambrose, 337 to 397, was not enough to affirm that the Jews were no longer a part of the church. The church must also exert the judgment of God upon them. Then we came to Augustine, 135 to 430, wrote that Christians were not allowed to kill Jews. However, God had to keep the Jews alive to use them as a negative example of divine judgment on the nation that abandons him. Thus, Christians felt authorized to persecute the Jews without killing them. He was very kind. It continued on. John Chrysostom in 134 to 355, from then to 407, hated Jews and preached 8 famous sermons full of venom against them. He warned his listeners to have nothing to do with the Jews, neither in their daily contact nor by visiting their synagogues or participating in religious occasions. For him, it was necessary that Christians avoid any contact with Jews in order to not get infected with the Jewish disease. Although these theologians claimed to know the scriptures and the plan of God concerning the role of Jews in God's plan for salvation, they were blinded. Emperor Constantine used the Christian church as a unifying factor for the Roman Empire. In 321 AD, he ordered the date for Easter to be changed so that its relationship to the Passover may be lost. 6 centuries later, this kind of preaching bore the fruit of an ever-mounting psychological hatred. The Crusaders are often remembered in Christendom for their chivalry, faith, and zeal. In reality, many of the Crusaders were cruel men who hated Jews with a passion. In 1000 AD, when the Crusaders first arrived in the Holy Land, there were approximately 300,000 Jewish residents still there. When the Crusaders left the scene 200 years later, only 1,000 Jewish families remained. But this was not the end of the hatred of the Jews. Spain, the Alhambra Decree, also known as the Edict of Expulsion, was issued on the 31st of March 1492 by the joint Catholic monarchs, which ordered the expulsion of the practicing Jews from their kingdoms and possessions by the 31st of July of that year, resulting in more than 40,000 being expelled. Anti-Semitism was not confined merely to the Catholic Church. Anti-Semitism is also found in the writings of the Protestant reformers, men who were supposedly cleansed the Roman Church of its corruption and theological errors. Initially, the reformer Martin Luther was sympathetic to the Jews. But in 1543, Luther advocated the expulsion of Jews from Germany as well as the destruction of their synagogues and religious books. He wrote, first their synagogues should be set on fire, and whatsoever is left be buried in the dirt, so no one may be able to see a stone or a cinder from it. Jewish prayer books should be destroyed. Then the Jewish people should be dealt with, their homes smashed and destroyed. Jews shall be banned from the roads and markets, should be drafted into forced labor and made to earn their bread by the sweat of their noses. These very words were used by the Nazis when they came into power. The infamous Nazi death camp, Dachau, greeted Jews arriving there with a sign that read, "You are here because you killed our God." The fundamental assumption still promulgated today amongst many Christians is that because Israel rejected Jesus as Messiah, God had cast the Jewish people cast off the Jewish people as a chosen nation. Consequently, in judgment, God had dispersed the Jews into the nations. The land of Canaan, promised to Abraham and his seed, had been forfeited, and the Jews no longer had a legal claim to it. But what about the restoration of Israel? It's interesting what Mark Twain commented about Jerusalem, when he said, "Many are Israel's forsaken places, and great is the desecration. The more sacred the place, the greater the devastation it has suffered. Jerusalem is the most desolate place of all." He wrote that in 1879. However, despite being stripped of their homelands, scattered to the four corners of the earth, despite repeated attempts of forced conversions and their own attempts of assimilation, the Jews have survived as a distinct nation. No other ethnic group in the history of mankind has been so dispersed, faced such odds, and yet endured. What explains this apparent invincibility? Jehovah, in the words of Malachi, reads, I, the Lord, do not change. So you, as sons of Jacob, are not consumed. Malachi 3:6. Next year in Jerusalem, the Jewish people never gave up the hope of a return to the promised land. Next year in Jerusalem was a phrase sung at the end of the Passover and also Yom Kippur. It appears to have started in the 10th century and is still used today. The hope of many of the Jews is to make Aliyah, the act of going up, that is, towards Jerusalem. The singing of next year in Jerusalem at the Passover is especially significant as it reminds the Jews of when they were freed from slavery in Egypt and the promise of Jeremiah. Therefore, behold, days are coming, declareth the Lord, when it will no longer be said, as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives, who brought up the sons of Israel from the land of the north and from all the countries where he had banished them. For I will restore them to their own land, which I gave to their fathers. Jeremiah 16:14-15. We continue on with Zionism. Thus saith the Lord, if my covenant for day and night stand not, and the fixed patterns of the heavens and the earth I have not established, then I would reject the descendants of Jacob and David my servant, not taking from his descendants rulers over the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But I will restore their fortunes, and I will have mercy on them. Jeremiah 33:25-26. The state of Zionism can be traced back to 1870, when the lovers of Zion societies were starting in Russia and Romania to promote the agricultural settlement in the land of Israel. In the same year, Merkav Israel was opened in Jaffa as an agricultural school, which is still operating today. And between 1882 and 1903, the first large-scale immigration, Alia, started. 1896. For many people, Theodor Herzl is seen as the father of Zionism, who wrote The Jewish State, asserting that the problem of anti-Semitism can only be resolved by the formation of a Jewish state. Years before this, Brother Charles Russell was traveling the world holding Jewish mass meetings beginning in 1879, at which he urged Jews to find a national home in Israel. And in 1892, he wrote, "There are now in the world more than 10,000 Jews, about three-quarters of whom are in Russia, Poland, and the Balkan states, and Turkey. If the movement towards Palestine should get the impulse that Hershon Committee is able to give it, an imaginative person could conceive of the country doubling or tripling its Jewish population before the end of the century." Zion's Watchtower, 1892. The proposition boldly put forward by Pastor Russell contrasted with the position of many Catholic churches at the time, where the feeling was that God's covenant with the Jews had long since ended, and the blessings now belonged to the Christians. On October 9, 1910, Pastor Russell gave a talk titled "Zionism in Prophecy" before an audience of 4,000 Jews at the Hippodrome, New York's largest and finest auditorium at the time. He held similar meetings throughout the U.S., England, and Europe. "Thy Kingdom Come," the volume that we're looking at. In 1891, Brother Russell published the third volume titled "Thy Kingdom Come." In the volume, he sets out what he had expected to happen as the world came closer to the setting up of Christ's kingdom. One whole study is devoted to the restoration of Israel. Brother Russell introduces the chapter with the promise to Amos, "In that day I will rise up the fallen booth of David and wall up its breaches. I will also rise up its ruins and rebuild it as in the days of old. Also I will restore the captivity of my people Israel, and they will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine, and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from their land, which I have given them, saith the Lord your God," in Amos 9:11-15. He goes on to point out that although they were dispersed throughout the world, they were not absorbed into the cultures of the nations to which they fled. They maintain many of their religious ways, their language. They remain committed to the oracles of Jehovah. And we remember Paul writing, then what advantage has the Jew? Or what is the benefit of circumcision? Great in every respect. For of all that they were entrusted with the oracles of God, what then? If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? Romans 1 and verse 3. Although there are many Christians today that continue to deny the promises of God for the Jews, however, the promise still remains valid because of Jehovah's promise to Abraham. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. I will give to you and to your descendants all the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan, an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. In Genesis 17, 7 to 8. As a people, the Jews still have a measure of faith in the promises. Many, even secular Jews, remember the Passover, remembering when they were rescued from Egypt. The Atonement Day, Yom Kippur, lamented the fact that they have no temple, no high priest, no altars on which to offer sacrifices. They fail to see that these have finished, being replaced by a Lord's memorial, and that the ransom had been paid. They still hold faith in the promises of the coming of the Messiah, although they reject Christ at his first advent. Paul made the following statement about the Jews, but their minds were hardened. For unto this day, at the reading of the Old Covenant, some veils remain unlifted because it is removed in Christ. 2 Corinthians 3 and 14. And this statement remains true to today. The promise of the end of Gentile rule, Brother Russell saw, had a marked beginning in the year 1878 as a result of the Berlin Conference Congress of Nations. The chief figure at that conference was Lord Beaconsfield, Benjamin Disraeli, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. The Jews now enjoyed greater privileges in the land of their fathers than they had been accorded for centuries. They were no longer merely dogs to the insolent Turks. He saw 1914 as a pivotal moment in God's plan. The start of World War I and the turmoil that that caused, especially the attacks on the Ottoman Empire, forcing it out of Israel, gave Brother Russell hope that the state of Israel would be the result, that this event would bring about the end of Gentile rule over Israel, mentioned by the Apostle Paul in Romans 11. Brother Russell saw that there were so many verses in the Old Testament with the promise of the restoration of Israel. Many Christians still unfortunately spiritualize these promises. This was especially true for the British Israelites, who saw themselves as the 10 lost tribes and thus entitled to all the blessings awaiting natural Israel. In 1916, Brother Russell wrote an updated foreword to the third volume. I write in part, we are free to say that the restoration of Israel has not been accomplished as rapidly as we had anticipated. Nevertheless, the Jews in Palestine seem to be thus far wonderfully sheltered, and doubtless many of their co-religionists in the war districts, especially in Poland, would be glad if they had gone to Palestine when they had the opportunity. It is difficult to say how the conclusion of the war may affect the interests of Israel. We then came to the interesting verse in Jeremiah 16:16. Behold, I am going to send for many fishermen, declares the Lord, and they will fish for them, and afterwards I will send for many hunters, and they will hunt them from every mountain and every hill and from the clefts of the rock. Sending fishermen. Fishermen often use baits or lures to catch the fish. And in any ways, this was the first method used to start the return of Jews to Israel. The Zionist movement, the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which pledged British government support for the establishment of the Jewish national home in Palestine. The British mandate over Palestine in 1920 was supposed to assist Jews who wished to return. It was confirmed by the League of Nations in 1922. However, the interesting point is the League and Great Britain decided that the Jews would not have the east side of Jordan. The hunters. World War II breaks out, 1st of September. A master plan to liquidate the Jewish community in Israel, in Egypt, is put into motion by Nazi Germany. Some 6 million Jews, including 1.5 million children, are murdered by the Nazis between 1939 and 1945. Jews are hunted from every country in the world by anti-Semitic action. This was even prevalent while the Jews were being killed at death camps. Those that fled were denied entry to the US and Canada, being turned back to Europe and the death camps. After the war, the Jews that fled to the refugee camps tried to enter Israel, only to again be turned away by the British government. 1948. Finally, the British king's rule over Israel comes to an end. The State of Israel is proclaimed on the 14th of May by David Ben-Gurion, hours before the British mandate is due to end on the 15th of May. War of Independence began the next day. The armies of Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon, and a contingent from Iraq attacked the new state. In 15 months of intermittent fighting, all the invaders are repulsed. 1967, the majority of us here will remember, was the Six-Day War. It ran from the 6th to the 11th of June. Jerusalem is liberated. The Golan Heights are taken by Israel from after fierce fighting against attacking Syrian forces. Judea, Samaria, Gaza, and the Sinai Peninsula come under Israeli control. Jerusalem is officially united. Israel still does not have the land as promised to Abraham. The total restoration of Israel. Jehovah has given this promise to Israel. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent, and for Jerusalem's sake, I will not keep quiet, until her righteousness goes forth like a brightness, and her salvation like a torch that is burning. The nations will see your righteousness and all kings your glory. And you will be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord will designate. You will also be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. It'll no longer be said to you, forsaken, nor to your land, that it may be said desolate. But you will be called my delight in her, and your land married, for the Lord delights in you, and to him your land will be married. That's Isaiah 62:1-4. On this mountain he will swallow up the coverings which is over all the people, even the veil which is stretched over all the nations. He will swallow up death for all time, and the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and he will remove the reproach of his people from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken, and it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God, from whom we have been waiting that he might save us. This is the Lord from whom we have waited. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation. Isaiah 25:7-9. We watch and we wait for the full restoration of the land of Israel and for their acceptance of Christ as their head. May God add his blessing and a beautiful verse. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose.